Good evening and welcome to The Temple, the official Mayan Factor podcast. I am Brian the Mayan and I'm going to be your host this evening. Tonight in The Temple, we have Jim Noland, the patron saint of the Sunrise Martini. Jim is a very close friend of the band. He's a solo artist currently. He previously played in projects Newcastle and also Medium Underground, which for a time had Ray involved in it. A lot of songs you'll hear, some on the 44 record, a lot on the Yesterday's Sun record, started in Jim's basement. There was a lot of jams that happened over at Jim's place, a lot of good vibes and a lot of good times. Tonight it's my pleasure to bring you my good friend, Jim Noland. Everyone, please welcome this evening to The Temple. I know you're doing solo stuff now, and you're in Medium Underground, and I apologize. I don't remember what the name of the band you were doing before Medium Underground was.
Well, it sort of morphed over a period of time. It started out as a group called Newcastle, and then it sort of morphed, and then there was sort of this place in between where Ray and I were working on some stuff, and it was called Medium for a while, and that didn't quite pan out. It was difficult to figure out how to identify Medium. You can't do medium.com. You can't, you know, it's all, that stuff's already taken. So it sort of morphed from there. We were all sitting at a pub around the corner from my house.
And oh, EA talking Bose.
About, yeah, talking about, like, well, what the heck is this band going to be called? And I started thinking about it. So, well, it's not, you know, it's still Ray writing this stuff, you know, for the most part. So maybe it's a branch off of sort of the Mayan Factor thing. And it's the band is called Warflower. And that's sort of how that whole thing picked up momentum and so took off. And
if I'm not mistaken, like, he was playing with you and you guys, Mold, I think, was one of the songs you recorded. Is that right? Like, I mean, you recorded that at your place, wasn't it?
Yeah. So that was pretty wild. The movie House of Wax was in production, and, you know, some of the guys out of New York brought up the idea of Ray writing a track for it, and he came down to the studio and said, "I've got this idea," and so we spent a lot of time kind of playing around with the, you know, the bass of it that he had, and then we put this piece together, and it was a lot of collaboration. In fact, Ian, do you remember Ian from Pose?
Oh yeah, Ian. Didn't Ian own EA Pose? Wasn't that his spot?
Yeah, he was one of the co-owners. So he even sat down with us and helped, you know, kind of pen through some of the lyrics. And we went on this whirlwind recording session that over, God, it was almost like 2 days straight.
Wow, man, Ian
pulled,
dude,
this piece together.
Like, I remember EA Pose, and I think I was sitting around the other day trying to remember, you know, who's the guy that owned it, you know, real close to Ray, and that place was fun, man. That place was a great spot.
Yeah, well, it was really the focal point, right? That's where I met you guys, that's where I met Ray, that's where the whole thing sort of, it all started, it all, you know, that was the genesis of it.
Dude, EA Pose, I have some great memories and some pretty traumatic memories.
Yeah, I think there was some. I think there was some stuff there.
Well, dude, I remember there was I think the first time I played there, I had just started a new job, and you know, in my sales career, and I was moving up, and there was like a cancer benefit, and there was a girl who they were raising money for, and you know, I got to, you know, yep. Hey, my effect, let's go play there, and I was torn. I was like, you know, I'm just starting this new job, but I said, you know, it's jobs. You know, this is something to raise some money to maybe help save somebody's life. That's more important. So I remember going there and playing it, and it was awesome. Of course, I met Ian. I think that's where sort of we met you, right?
Yeah. So it was right around that time you guys were out there. That was a great show. I remember Bobby Hurt from Crack the Sky showed up and did a bit, and my band played there. You guys played, and
Was that Newcastle that played? That was Newcastle, right?
Yeah, I think we were probably Newcastle at that point. I can't remember what we were. We were still kind of changing out members and figuring out what we were doing. And the first album, I hadn't even really finished writing, let alone recording the first album. But what became the Medium Underground album. But yeah, so it's funny. This thing happened where there was a guy that worked there, Andy, and Andy is Ray's brother or half brother. I don't know. It's hard to tell because Ray called all of us brother.
Yeah,
so it was kind of, he said, "Oh, this is my brother." So it was always hard to know, is it like his real brother or his half brother? Is it? We were all brother. It's all spiritual brothers. But so Andy comes up to me and he says, "Hey, you play in a band, and my brother, he's in a band, and they're putting out this record." And you know, how many times have I heard this? You know, and I'm thinking, "Oh God, here we go." You know, you want to listen to the CD? So we go out, we get in my truck, and he pops the CD in, and it is, in fact, the first Mayan Factor album. And Warflower comes on, and I'm sitting there, and I'm listening to this, and I start to think, okay, he's really just bullshitting me, right? You know, this is a band that's already out. They're made probably from Europe. They're already established, and he's just trying to spin it like it's his brother's band. So now I've got this sort of incredulous sort of look on my face as this music comes on. And I start really digging it, and I'm thinking, there's no way in the hell that this is his brother's band. And we listen to the album, and I'm dumbfounded. It's, you know, just these soaring guitar landscapes and this deep, brooding, dark, tribal, rhythmic thing going on. And actually, my hair is standing up even thinking about it. I remember this like it was yesterday. And this was probably 2002 or 2003 or something.
That sounds about right. That was about the right time.
Right before the first album came out. And when it was over, I said, okay, I got to meet this guy. So, you know, shortly after that, Ray shows up and we start talking. And I can't believe it. I'm like, you know, this incredible, incredible sound. And, you know, right in the middle of it is this guy, this really unassuming, very sort of quiet most of the time kind of guy. And that's how it all started. That was the whole beginning of, you know, the next thing, we were in the studio and we were cutting tracks like When I Was Loved, and just, you know, I couldn't get enough out of just like jumping into this music. And then, you know, eventually everyone gets to see their first Mayan Factor show, right? And it's unbelievable because you guys have all got your shoes kicked off. You know, you do your shot of tequila before you get up on stage. And it becomes this thing that's bigger than the sum of the parts. It really does. And I don't mean that in a just sort of, you know, facetious way or just blowing smoke
lie,
up anybody.
No, you're right, dude. I just kind of got chills because that's kind of it's kind of the point is that, you know, we want to go to this place. Like we're trying to get to that place, and we're hoping to take people with us. You know, and that was always that was always a focus. And it's so great, flattering actually, to hear somebody say it.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it was almost like the priests have stepped into the sweat lodge, and we're all in the sweat lodge together, and it starts, and it's almost like this vortex opens up. And the thing that struck me the most, I remember turning at one point, I was standing over by Frank at the mixing console, and I looked out, and this whole room full of people are singing these lyrics back to you guys. And I'm thinking, this is something is largely reserved for arena events. You know, some superstar band comes through, and you're going to have, you know, everybody singing Journey's lyrics back to them, or everybody singing, you know, whatever. That doesn't happen with local bands. It really doesn't. And I remember being stunned by that phenomena, that there were people tuned into this local band. But that was just a sort of omen of things to come. You know, it's really amazing.
That was a great night.
It just slipped out globally. And everyone, you know. So, yeah, so that was how I got my... My Mayan Factor cherry pop.
Dude, EA Pose, I got a lot of... I'll just real quick, I got a couple really cool EA Pose stories. The there's one time we played a show there and the Moose came up. And There's some crazy, I don't know how it worked out, but there was some really drunk girl that was there while we were playing, and she was practically raping the moose while we were playing on top of a table. And like, we're dying. Like, we can barely play our instruments. We're laughing so hard. Like, and she's like, yeah, moose. And Moose is like, he's into it. He's like, yeah, I'm getting this, man. I was like, oh, that was such a great. And another one, man, I loved EA Pose. I wish that place was still there, man. We had a jam session, which I want to talk, man. The only note that I wrote down was Jim Nolan, patron saint of the Sunrise Martinis. And we'll get there. One morning that Ray and I woke up and we were going to record some songs at your house in the studio downstairs. And Ray goes, let's, we woke up. Granted, we say we woke up. It wasn't morning. It was afternoon when we woke up. And he goes, let's go to EA Pose and do some Jaeger bombs. You know how Ray does that, the Jaeger bomb. You know, and when we did Jaeger bombs, it wasn't like a little, it was a full can of Red Bull and a shot of Jaeger. I think I did 5 Jaeger bombs and Ray did 6. And I was so whacked out. And I think we went back to your house and did a couple bong hits. I don't know if it's okay that we, is it okay to say that I did bong hits at your house on?
I'm sure I have no idea what a bong is, so good, that's fine, I'm sure.
I'm sure that you don't. I don't think I've ever been so tweaked out. Like I never want to be in that place ever again, but Ray was like, yeah! That was awesome. Of course, we did have the night, and I don't even know if you were there at EA Pose, that I think it was a Red Gone Blue. Before 44 came out, we were working on a Red Gone Blue, and it was a night where we had had a lot to drink, and Ray had decided he wanted to play it on stage, and a couple of songs later, again wanted to play it, and it caused a sort of meltdown and a fight on stage.
I remember that night. Yeah, I think he and Kevin got into it.
Yeah, literally physically. Like, I can remember coming home and seeing my, you know, she wasn't my wife then, but I could come back and see my wife and say, man, this might be over. Like, that was a bad night for everybody. Like, it was game over, man.
Yeah, well, I think there was, and this is true of a lot of great bands, you know, there's always the potential for some volatility because, you know, the intensity of this stuff. I mean, any way you slice it, you know, Ray could be a very difficult person to work with musically or even just interpersonally. You know, there were times when he got something in his head and that was, you know, I'll be damned, you know, everything else be damned.
You know, what's funny though, man, is that after that, it was all weird. Like for about a week or so or whatever, it was weird. And then we had another show and everybody was sort of tentative about it, but we all showed up at the show and we all were like, is everybody good? I was like, yeah, but we were still a little tentative. And then we went on stage and had one of the best shows, you know, of that time. Like, we just went up and killed it. And it was like, okay, doesn't matter. We survived that. Let's keep moving on, which I thought was pretty cool. You know, I felt relieved at that point.
Yeah, sure. You know, it just sort of picks up and keeps going. And God, what a life of its own it took on. You know, it's easy to look back now and see mostly the positive stuff, but there was so much craziness. Like the constant, you know, everybody's phone is on speed dial because everybody's got to find out where Ray is. You know, so there's, you know, 2 hours before the show, everybody's calling each other and trying to figure out, oh, is he at your place? Is he there?
No shit, man. No shit.
You know, it was, and so we used to, I think we used to call that the radar.
The radar.
Is he on the radar?
Oh, I forgot about that. That's exactly what we called it, the radar.
And I thought, you know.
No, you're right.
Probably one of these podcasts needs to be just called the Ray Ray Factor. And it'll be a whole discussion of all the crazy.
Oh, dude. That episode would be like 79 hours long. I don't know how it.
It most certainly would. I tell you though, there's some really bright moments for me. So, you know, getting to, and I've worked with a lot of musicians and not only as a musician, but as an engineer and you know, had a great opportunity to play and work with a lot of people. But getting to work with you guys, you know, those jams in the basement and a lot of that work, you know, recording in the studio and getting a chance to really really get in and work with this vibe, this energy that was going on in those songs, and just everything was a real highlight in my life. I mean, some of the most intense musical experiences. And I was just thinking, in fact, I just pulled up a review. Do you remember Holly Banks?
Oh, dude. Holly is maybe one of the greatest people that I know. I love Holly. Like, there are just people who are pure, and I don't mean this like to sound weird, but he's a sweet man. Like, he's just an honest, beautiful person. And I don't mean, I hope people don't take that out of context. One of the best people I know. I hope to see him sometime soon.
Yeah, Holly is definitely a great guy. Well, I stumbled across a review that he wrote, a show that, you know, the four of us did. Well, it was a Mayan Factor and a Medium Underground show at Fletcher's, but the four of us opened up with that acoustic set. And Holly was so moved that he wrote a review about that.
Oh,
and I was just...
Dude, I remember that little acoustic bit. Dude,
yeah,
that's...
Yeah.
Whoa, do you have a recording of that? Or do you
so
know
here's the
has?
Thing. I told the engineer, I said, listen, I want you to record the set tonight, you know? And I guess he didn't get that I was referring to not only Medium Underground, but this opening acoustic bit. So the only recording of it, and it exists somewhere on a magnetic tape somewhere, my son had a digital camera and was taping the entire thing. But when I came down after the show, after that set, and walked over to the engineer, I said, you know, let me get the CD. And he said, I didn't burn a CD of that. You know, you didn't, you said, you know, you wanted your set recorded. I didn't know you were going to be in there. So, and the second person to come up and say, Kevin came up to me and said, tell me you got a recording of that. But...
Do you remember what songs we played? I'm guessing we played...
You know,
maybe
we did. So let me read this. This is a paragraph. Let me read this to you. This is what Holly wrote for his review. The lights dimmed. The opening set was acoustic, performed by Ray Ray and Brian from the Mayans, and Jim Nolan and guitarist Larry Wilson from Medium Underground. The four musicians played in various combinations. At one point, when Ray, Brian, and Jim were performing, a mighty voice hurled from the crowd, yeah, saying, who are you guys, Crosby, Stills, and Nash? It's always good to hear and see Eric the Moose. Jim and Ray sang original stuff they've worked on over the last year. They performed Beauty and the Beast, a Mayan tune, their voices blending like cream and coffee. Jim and Ray are buds from back in the day, see? So help me, good reader, they sang Sounds of Silence. And only Tom and Jerry, excuse me, I'm showing my age again, only Simon and Garfunkel themselves could have done it better, assuming there is nothing so good as an original, and I think maybe that is true. Readily apparent to the ear and acknowledged by all, chemistry percolates between Ray and Jim. And I thought that was really freaking cool.
I could tell that's absolutely Holly writing right there. That's just beautiful.
It really is.
No, that was really special, man. I can remember playing that little acoustic bit before the set and remembering how good it was. Like, it really went over well. That was a great thing.
Yeah. My only wish is that it had actually been captured. But it was one of the few times that I got to grace the stage with Ray and you, as that was generally a pretty separate endeavor. Ray and I did a lot of, like, kind of coffee house and open mic things. We did a lot of those over the years. But being up on the Fletcher stage was kind of home base in a lot of ways for the whole Mayan experience.
Did we ever get to play together? I think at least maybe once or twice as 13th Hour. Didn't we play at least once or twice together that way?
Yeah, we might have. Yeah, it's hard for me to recapture all of those things. It's funny, when I was down in the studio the other day looking through all these different recordings and trying to find the date stamps on them, like, when did we do this? When did we do this? And I love seeing date stamps. Like, one of them was like 2005 or something, and the timestamp on it was 4:30 in the morning. And that's what we do. We jam these things all night long, and then inevitably everyone would sort of pass out one at a time.
Okay,
they'd
so,
be done.
Okay, so hold on. Before we get into that, I wrote down here Jim Noland. patron saint of the Sunrise Martini. So I need you to paint that story for me. Tell me about, I want people to hear about, what is a Sunrise Martini?
Yeah, so this dovetails nicely into what I was just talking about. You know, us finishing these jams, and you know, after a while you can't go on any longer, but you're still pumped, you know, from this great music. And we used to have these great, you know, dinner parties, you know, just spreads of food and just jam sessions all night. And one by one, everybody kind of dropped out. And I think your, at that point, soon to be wife was even there that night.
And yeah, John, she came out for a couple of, I can remember, there was always like, you know, smoked salmon on the grill and chicken cacciatore, which Ray used to call chicken casserole. Chicken casserole. And there was just a feast. Like, there was a feast. Like, the food was unbelievable. And there was bottles of wine, and we were drinking, and jams would start sort of late in the evening, but they would go just until people started falling. It was all night.
Yeah, so that's what happened. That particular night, you know, everyone was out. And in fact, Joe was in. She was asleep on the sofa, I think, and you and I kind of staring around, and we're the only ones left. And I don't think either one of us were ready to crash, so I pulled out two martini glasses, and we poured out some dirty martinis and just kind of were shooting the shit. And it started to get lighter and lighter. And I remember this specifically about that. We were talking quietly because everyone was kind of crashed out on various sofas. And I said, "Brian, when are you going to make that girl an honest woman?" And unbeknownst to both of us, she was actually kind of awake and listening to us talk. And you said, "Yeah, man, I really want to. And I think I scored points there at that point." Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, this gym guy's all right.
Dude, those were...
But yeah, that's the history of the Sunrise Martini.
God, that was a great... We had a couple jams like that. I can remember there was a jam at your house we had where I stayed over and woke up the next day. It was hot. I can remember being hot. I was so just crushingly hungover. And you had that little pool, like that inflatable kind of, it wasn't like a small pool, but you know, I didn't have any Advil or anything. I was like, all I want to do is get cool. And I went to the pool and was just like, oh, this is the best thing ever. You know, but the night before it'd been brilliant, man, just music, you know, it was so good. You know, Ray had stayed with you. Ray lived with you not all the time, but, you know, he stayed at your place, and you guys wrote music and, you know, a lot
of
stuff.
Ray lived at the house on and off for about 5 years. I mean, there were periods of time where, you know, a year and a half at a stretch, you know, he'd be there. And it was really great, you know, in that way because, you know, I'd come home from work and, you know, the studio was right there. You know, it was always available. So... that blueprint was laid with that whole, that first track, When I Was Loved, which was great because he played it for me. And I said, "Is that going to be on, you know, one of the Mayan albums?" He said, "I don't know." And I said, "Well, let's just work it up in the studio. We'll just work it up." And, we started laying the tracks, and then I started getting ideas on the production and laying backing tracks and sort of rondoing some of the stuff at the end. And, at one point, Ray turned to me and said, "That's some Frank Marchand shit right there, man. That's good." And I thought, okay, that's kind of cool. I'll take that compliment. And I remember because, you know, there was a woman that Ray saw a long time ago, Danielle. And she showed up at the house one day. And I was so beamingly proud of this song, When I Was Loved. Such a touching, lovely piece of music, and very, very poignant lyrics. You know, him asking, you know, what if I could be good enough? Would you stay? You know, wasn't I good enough? And I thought, man, it's so heart wrenching and sad, but beautiful. And so I played it for her, and I turned around after the track finished, and she had been reduced to tears. And in that moment, I realized that that song largely was written about her, and I felt terrible. But this is the way of a lot of this music. It just evokes these emotions. You know, that's the beauty of the whole Mayan Factor scene. I love hearing how people interpret some of his words, some of the things people write into those songs.
This song is so beautiful. Like, really, it's anybody, anybody who's ever loved anybody can understand what that song is.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I can't even imagine, you know, the object of that song coming in and being there and hearing the song. I would have no words. I'd be like, I'd be like, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's,
yeah.
That's well,
it struck me hard. Yeah, it really, and we actually played it live at EA Pose one night. I think you guys had just finished playing. I think I was running sound for you guys. And
maybe my memory's fuzzy. Did Hugin ever play acoustic and do vocal harmonies with us on that?
God, I don't know.
Because I can remember Brian Hugin doing stuff with us on Hell, but I thought maybe my memory's all fucked up. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, because he was always kind of there. He was always around. I mean, some of these jam sessions, it was Brian playing, it was Hugin playing, or Pittsburgh, as
yeah,
he's affectionately known. and other times it was my cousin Ryan from up in PA who would come down and sit in on some of these sessions. So it was, but yeah, it was always amazing to me. You know,
did he play drums? He played drums, right?
Yeah, well, Ryan, I mean, he's incredibly talented. He plays drums, he plays keys, he plays guitar.
Did he play drums when we recorded, I guess, the track for River's End? A little song I wrote and, you know, Ray had played on it. Like, when you start playing it, he, like, jingles the chain. Like, he found a chain hanging from your ceiling and picked it up and just jingled it at the beginning. And I was like, oh, that's so
good.
That
was Ryan, yeah.
That was Ryan.
I remember that.
That is a great live track, man. Like, that was such a good recording. It was, you know, Ray had messed around with it. And we're like, yeah, let's feel it out, you know. And I can remember because I was playing this really crappy Bronco Vegas. Matt Toronto had this really shitty Telecaster. Like the Squire Telecaster with like three strings on it. And I was like, can I fix it up? He's like, whatever, you can have it. So I fixed it up and I can remember, you know, Ray was playing, I was playing on that Telecaster, which I thought sounded great. Can I tell you, I have no idea where that thing is today. I have no idea where it went. It's like the brotherhood of the traveling shitty Telecaster. You know, you know, things go. Anyway, I can remember recording it and I can remember hearing the chain. You know, he's playing the chain, and I listen back to it. It's like reliving that one moment. Like, that live recording, you know, may not be the greatest recording, but I can feel, like, that was a great little moment. Like, it just captured something fucking special, which is really nice. You guys did a lot of it there. You know, Ray stayed with you on and off for a while. I don't know if you've heard the Yesterday's Sun, Mayan Factor Yesterday's Sun album. A lot of that stuff, and not all of it, but a lot of that stuff was written in your basement, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I have early recordings of songs like Parabellum. You know, I'm assuming you guys call these by the same name, but songs like Parabellum and Wicker Basket, or, I don't know how many of the songs that we wrote there translated over directly, but yeah, there's a ton of tunes that, you know, in various states of recording or in various states of being finished, but certainly a lot of them made it onto that Yesterday's Sun, which, by the way, is a great, great name for that album in particular.
Oh yeah. Now I didn't play on that one. That was Johnny played guitar on that record, and I think at the time, like the Mayans weren't playing together, and I got together with Ray, and not all those songs, but some of the songs we picked up, and Ray and I were playing in a band we were called. Originally, we were talking about calling it Warflower, but then we changed it up to 13th Hour. I think you were part of that for a little while. And a lot of the songs that were written in your basement were, I mean, literally, they were written at your place, like sussed out, worked out, and then we worked on them. And then that, for whatever reason, that didn't work out. Like, that just never came to fruition. Ray carried those on. A lot of those songs, man, that are on that record, which sounds great. You know, Johnny did a good job doing guitar stuff on that. a lot of those ended up being on that that Yesterday Sun record, and a lot of that came out of where he was there, man. Like,
yeah, I remember Ray kind of having a little bit of heartache over what to release where. Where does it belong? Where does it go? I think in some ways he thought that those were kind of outside of the Mayan sort of circle. They had been written outside of the Mayan circle, much the way Mold had been written, or Anew, or some of these other songs. They had been crafted outside of that circle. But in the end, you know, it all just folds in. You know, it's wherever he takes it, it exists. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm glad some of those songs saw the light of day on that album.
Yeah, I mean, not all of them did. You know, I don't think Wicker Basket made it there. There was quite a few that didn't make it there. But there were, like, I know Dead Leaves started in your basement. I know Parabellum started in your basement. Off the top of my head, I don't recall. But I mean, clearly, a lot of those things started there. Like, he was living there. Like, it was inspired there. A lot of that stuff was worked out there. So it's kind of like a special little spot. Like, what was it that, sometimes in mind, like, what was it that inspired in that little spot? You know, you had a very creative little placement. Who was your, you had a buddy that, I think it was like a roommate, the keyboard.
Yep, there, John. Yeah, John lived with me for quite a while. And that was a great, you know, asset there to have, because you've got this guy with a very accomplished keyboard player that was able to sometimes sit in. In fact, I'd come home sometimes and the two of them would be downstairs working on a song that just came out of nowhere, you know, with John playing piano and Ray singing along.
I like John, but I can remember having a jam session at your house one night, and John goes to Ray, so what are you playing? What key are you playing in? And Ray goes to me, he's like, so what key are we playing? I'm like, it's the key of Z, man. Just figure it out. It's kind of like...
that was always the funny thing, and it's one of the ways I can relate to Ray, because I am not an accomplished or learned musician.
Yeah, but
musician,
John was. So. Like, he was, you know.
Yes.
And neither am I at all, anyway.
But it was always funny, because I used to get the same thing from Larry, you know, the guitarist in Medium Underground. He'd say, what key are you playing? And I said, I don't know. I'm tuned to Dadgad, and I'm capoed on the third. He's like, okay, strum it. So I'd strum it, and he'd figure it out. He's an absolute brilliant musician. He'd figure it out and say, okay, now what are you singing on top of that? And I put it all together. He's like, okay, you're in the key of this. I'm like, I have no idea. But, yeah, it was kind of funny. And it's funny because Ray and I used a lot of the same tunings for writing. So it was, which I have a lot of very odd tunings I use for my original stuff. So when I met Ray and he started retuning for all these songs, I thought, okay, this is cool. He's using the same sort of made-up chords and the same open tunings that I use on a lot of my stuff. That was one of the first things I think that clicked between us. Some similarities there. But yeah, I wanted to circle back to this idea of like how people interpreted the Mayan Factor stuff, and I think why it was so important, and why the lyrics were never penned, why they were never published out there. And it was always amazing to me how people would hear a Mayan Factor song and they'd start singing along, and you had to chuckle sometimes because the lyrics were absolutely wrong.
Stuff, but they weren't.
But it was there. Lyrics. They had written themselves.
Yeah, the lyrics weren't
into
wrong.
The song.
No, the lyrics weren't ever wrong. You can have 20 people all singing different lyrics, and every single lyric was right, because it mattered what it meant. The song meant to them.
Yeah,
that's all that was important.
Yep. Yeah, it really was, and that really, I think, says a lot about how the music universally, like emotionally, could stimulate something in someone, and they would literally write their own story into it. And I thought that was absolutely one of the most amazing things about the Mayan Factor, in addition to this like ridiculously lush landscape of sound and rhythm, that it was so open and so universal. And I think that's really the thing that drove it globally. I mean, there are Mayan Factor fans all around the world, you know, Germany, Russia, Portugal. Ray's inbox was constantly full of these messages from people all around the world. It was amazing.
Hey, I wanted to, I might edit this one out, but I haven't really talked about anything like this on any of the other podcasts. But I mean, you were really close to Ray, and he lived with you for a while. And I ended up leaving the band and breaking ties with Ray because I was finally, I got to a point where I was like, you know what, man? Like, I'm investing so much time, I'm investing so much effort, putting so much forth, and you're letting me down over and over and over and over and over and over. I just can't do it anymore. Like, I just can't do you anymore. And finally cut ties with that. It's difficult to try to put that in words and tell a story. And I don't know how I'm going to do this on the podcast or even if I'll include it. But I know you were exceptionally close to Ray. And he broke my heart 100 times. And I'm sure, I know that he did with you. Now, how did you deal with that?
Yeah, well, it's... I think there's an expression, the flame that burns twice as bright burns half as long. And Ray didn't really have anything else in his world. I mean, music was his therapy. It was his religion. It was the thing that fed him. And he was a complicated guy in a lot of ways. He was very much like a little kid in a lot of ways. And I think that some of the things maybe you could attribute to childlike behavior, this sort of self-centeredness, the maybe egocentric piece. He was a handful at times. He was a real challenge.
All he ever had, man, was his music. All he ever had was his art. That was it. That's all he had. Because sometimes I think about it, that's why he was so... That's why he protected it so much, because that's all that he had.
Yep, I would 100% agree with that. It was always a topic of discussion. Talking to the guys in New York, they want to do this and they want to do that. And it was always, trying to be supportive of him, trying to, obviously, wanting to be engaged with this thing musically. But, there were times where it would get a little crazy. And, I have kids and they were young at the time. They were young enough to, there were times where I just had to put my foot down and say, no, this is not going to be crazy at my house. I can't. There has to be some sort of modicum of, sanity here. Having fun and jam sessions and the music. And my kids look back fondly on that. All three of my youngest daughters have tattoos on their back that say "Aim from the sky." Aim from the sky. Uncle Ray Ray. Uncle Ray Ray. He was the ever-present, always wild man. He was great. He was great with animals, with our dogs. He was amazing. But yeah, there were times where I just needed a break as well. I just couldn't take the intensity level. I couldn't take it being on all the time. And then there are times where it wasn't. But there are times where I just stayed up all night and listened to him and just let him talk as much as he wanted to about whatever. And, some of the stuff that came out was pretty intense. And so I think in one way, I tend to be a pretty empathetic and sympathetic person. On the one hand, he was like a younger brother to me, right? So I kind of wanted to, hold him and say, it's going to be cool. It's going to be all right, man. But he kind of struck me in a lot of ways as, pick your great artist that checked out early, whether it's Ronnie Van Zant, or whether it's Freddie Mercury. These guys, I think, had a foreshadowing. And you can hear that in Ray's music. You can hear it in a lot of those songs. There's recurring themes about pain, about, intense stuff.
Ray, man,
and
knowing pure bliss and crushing defeat all at the same time. It was absolutely bipolar. It was like these great moments and then like a crushing disappointment. It's funny, man. Like, you listen to his lyrics on a lot of the stuff there. It's like prophetic. He's like, I'm going to let you down. I'm going to fuck you up. And he wasn't bullshitting about that. Like, he sort of understood about like his situation. And there was genius to it. Like, there was a brilliance to it. And I'm not saying that he wasn't a beautiful person, because he was absolutely a beautiful person. Like, there was absolutely, just gorgeous. Like, there was so much charisma and so much wonderful but that came at a price. You know, you were going to pay it. Like, and I think everybody that knew him paid it.
I would say that is universally true. I don't know if we should start a support group or something. But, you know, I always felt like with Ray, it was like you're you know those big waves, those 90-foot waves that some people are crazy enough to surf. Well, I kind of felt it was
dude,
a little like
fucking
that.
Psycho
you,
enough to get on
you
that wave.
Got on the surfboard.
Amazing.
And all you can do is try and keep your balance. You're not in charge. You don't get to say odds which are, way it goes. All you have to try and
dude,
do is keep your balance.
Odds are you need somebody to slingshot you into the wave. Oh, that is the greatest analogy
exactly.
I've heard of.
Exactly.
Yeah, I didn't mean,
but that
yeah, I
was,
didn't even take a song.
That was part of what it was like.
Maybe take a sort of a somber turn down. I don't know if I'm going to edit this stuff out or not. Maybe I'll leave it. Fuck it. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, hey, sure.
Just a couple things and then probably going to just cut it out, and I'm sure we can do more in the future.
We haven't even touched the surface.
No, there's so much more, man. Like, there is so much. Like, everybody I've talked to, there's so much more to do. The Mayan Factor now, the new stuff that we're doing, like the direction that at least we're trying to go. I don't know if you've heard any of the new stuff, like. And there's not a lot of new stuff, you know, it's just some stuff we post up on Facebook for people to hear. Just honest reaction, like do you think it's a good idea? Like, how do you feel about that? Like, you were very intimate with the actual band and Ray, like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so I have heard a little bit of, the recordings that have been made. I haven't seen you guys live yet. And on the one hand, you know, I think it's phenomenal that the music gets to live on, because there's a lot of people that never got to hear it. And that's, you know, I think that's important. You know, it still has this relevance and it still has this potency to it. You know, the fact that Ray's not there, I mean, I'm not sure if that means that, you know, the band can't play anymore, you know? I mean, how many other bands have gone on after losing even an incredibly significant member and still been offering something that's, you know, legitimate and valid and tasty, you know, and fun to participate in, you know? I mean, heck, Queen, for God's sakes, is still out there doing it with various configurations and people still really dig it. So I think to that extent that, you know, if there's a demand for it, if people are hungry for it, and God knows the music is good enough. So, that's, you know, for me, it's a real personal thing, because it was very closely tied to Ray.
You know,
but,
it's funny, man.
Yeah, life moves on.
Everybody that I've talked to, doing podcasts or not doing podcasts, that's the one thing they always say about, you know, if they were in the band, if they weren't in the band, you know, if they were part of the experience. Everybody says that it was all very personal. I think, to me, that's a high compliment. Like, I mean, you know, it meant something. It was more than just a couple of idiots playing music on a stage. It was bigger than that.
I mean, it absolutely was. It was a phenomenon in and of itself, and I don't throw the word around lightly. I genuinely mean everything from the vibe in that room when you guys were playing, to the people singing those lyrics back on stage, to the intensity that just surrounded the whole thing. It was personal for people. It resonated with people in a very real and a very deep way. And that, you can't fake that. You can't mock that up. You can't produce it in New York City and crank it out on the Disney Channel or whatever, MTV. That comes from a place that's real. And the cool thing about it is you can't fake it. People know when it's real. They know when it's real.
I know you mentioned that you had heard one song on the podcasts that I've already done.
Well, the one that caught me, I was just, you know, as I listened through them, there was, I mean, I think Heaven was in there, or Hell, or whichever which I could never remember which was which. Ray always wanted to swap them out. But
you know, I think at the end of the day, he'd tell you, like, the really heavy one is heaven, and the really, like, morose one is hell. But I think that switched around over the years.
When I Was Loved popped up there, and I think that was the one that I commented on. You know, because it just, you know, that really never even sort of became a Mayan Factor tune. It just sort of was on its own little island, so to speak. Like, some of the songs were, ended up getting just, you know, parked in my basement or whatever. And so that was great to hear that came out.
There's at least that one. And I would say at least two or three more, if I remember thinking back, of songs that I've got tucked into the background of podcasts that were recorded in your basement. I'm sure of it. I found, before I started doing the podcast, I rounded up all the CDs and all the stuff. And you know what it was? I think Brian Hugan had asked to get some recordings and stuff. So I got everything together and I got some stuff out to him. And some of those songs were on there. And they're in the backgrounds of the podcasts. You know, if you listen to them, you know, you'll find them. I like parking some stuff like that in the background, little Easter eggs. Yeah, I don't know if anybody picks up on it, but for me, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, it definitely flavors and seasons the podcast. I think it's great to have music in the background.
Hey, thanks for being in the temple tonight. I want to do this again. I know I chitty-chatted with you about doing some of the podcasts. Maybe you running some on your own. I don't know if that's something you're interested in still doing. I think that would be super interesting.
We could do that.
Other people doing this with a total different feel. If you're up for it, man, that would be great.
Yeah, and no one's interviewed you yet.
Oh, yeah, so. I'm not that interesting. I'm not interesting at all. But, I mean, you know, if you wanted to do a podcast, I'd be happy to be on it.
Yeah, that would be great. I think there's quite a few people that have yet to make appearances that should have their piece.
Hey, man. Thanks. I really appreciate it, man. I'm going to hop off. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Sounds good. Take care, Brian.
Inside your little mind.